So you was talking about the fabrication place that you worked in Hackney from 1988 to 1990. Could you say a little bit more about the kind of work that you did there?
Yes, I can give an idea of when I actually applied for a job there. It was a cooperative and it was set up through a parent company setting up small businesses in the area for people who were thinking of working either for themselves or working in a small kind of company or outfit. And it was based in a building called the Print Factory or Print House in Ashman Street, Hackney E9. And I applied for a job there in a fabrication workshop, which was one of their small businesses that were operating from their premises. And it was advertised in a local newspaper or journal, and it was for position of metal worker as part of a co-op. And I applied for a job in summer of 1988, and then I went away on holiday, and I heard when I got back that they were interviewing, and I went for an interview and was successful and joined four other people in this cooperative, which was based in Hackney and in London. And the job was involving doing railings for residential properties and for other people, other concerns. We worked with Freeform, which was a group based in East London, and they were interested in artistic projects and housing estates and wherever. And so we had a mixed clientele of people commissioning metalworking jobs. And as part of being involved with that cooperative, I was a co-director, because a cooperative was meant to be on an equal basis, so there wasn't a hierarchy. There was more a case of, once people were familiar with what the work entailed, they were invited to become a co-director, which is quite good, really. It was it meant you were involved in decisions of how work was sought after, carried out and reviewed.
And also it was quite a small team, wasn't it? Because you said there
were basically four people, and it grew to about six people when we were very busy. And it involved visiting locations, sizing up jobs and manufacture in the workshop premises, and then installing on site. Mm. So we did work for Hammersmith Council and did some very large projects, did some work for Hackney Empire. The gates around the back were done by us, and just it was a very rich, varied schedule of work, really. Sometimes a bit more than we could manage, but we always kind of got things done.
Also, you was talking about the railway arch before, which, how long did you have the railway arch for?
Well, the railway arch, I actually only started working in the railway arch in October 1990, and that was not connected to my daytime job. So from 1988, when I was working full-time, I had studio space in the Acme House, and that was primarily at 103 Dyers Hall Road until June 1989, when we were evicted from that house. And I was working, obviously, in the fabrication job. And when we moved to 55 Dyers Hall Road in June 1989, there was some sort of studio space there.
Yeah.
So we had a continuation of studio space in the second Acme House, which I shared with Mark Sowden and Robert Lewinstein. And that carried on until the possibility of renting a studio in the area, i.e. a railway arch, because I got to know people in the railway arch who were carrying out a project for Wandsworth Arts. So sometime, I think it must have been the winter of 1989, we got involved in a commission that was primarily the work of Julia Barton, who was one of the members of Leighton Artist Group, and she was in need of extra assistance for a casting project. And Wandsworth Arts, the project was for Wandsworth Council or Wandsworth Arts, and they rented this railway arch for the winter of 1989. So we got involved, and that was about 6 weeks' work. And then when they finished with that, the premises were vacant, and we found out that we could take on the tenancy from the following year, which we did.
What road was that railway arch?
It was at the bottom of Connaught Road. It was just literally a stone throw from where we lived. And it was in Leytonstone, and it was actually called Railway Arches Grove Green Road.
Oh, okay.
So, and the railway arch we had was 188, which previously, prior to Wandsworth Arts actually doing their project in 89, the railway arch was looked after, was the workshop of a few artists. There were artists prior to that, one of whom was Peter Randall Page. So we found out later on.
Yeah. And can you describe what the house you were living at the time was like? Because you described the first house.
Right. The second house was a terraced house, very similar to the one we were in previously, except we were not the end terrace, so we didn't have any space at the side. So we had immediate neighbours on both sides. There was a lot less space in the garden. It was a small garden, and so it wasn't as easy making sculpture there, really. Not the kind of things we were involved with. So it was only a kind of a temporary setup, even though storage space, workspace was there. Really, you could only do small work or two-dimensional work.
You had quite a sculpture garden, didn't you?
Yeah, it was quite the previous place was a much larger space, and it was useful for putting sculptures out to look at, and we also could work there as well.
So how did you set up the space at the second house where you which rooms did you live in?
And right, it was very similar to the first house in as much as it had two bedrooms upstairs and bathroom upstairs, and it had two reception rooms or two rooms downstairs. And what we did was we used, I had the two rooms downstairs, so I had a bedroom and I had the front room as a work area. And then upstairs, Mark had a bedroom and studio. Well, the studio, he tended to either work in his room or work elsewhere, because I think he also realized that it wasn't as accommodating for making sculpture. So he was living there, and then he found somewhere else to work. He'd started working full-time as well. Rob, when he moved in, lived elsewhere and used the upstairs room as a studio.
Okay.
So Rob wasn't initially down on the tenancy from Acme. It was Mark and myself, but when we met Rob, he was in need of a studio space more than anything. He lived, I think he stayed, he has a, his parents were not that far away, so I think he stayed elsewhere. So yes, it was mainly a kind of a base for working for the three of us, and the railway arch was a much better concern for doing work. And as it was available, we just thought we'd try and see if we could secure it. When I say we, I was not taking it on with Mark. Mark was doing his own thing. I just met people from Wandsworth Arts, and they wanted to take on the railway arch. So three people, including myself, there was Rick Kirby, who lived in Buckhurst Hill, and he's a sculptor who we got to know through Leighton Artist Group, and he was very keen on a workspace such as the arch offered. He was getting quite sort of he was a practicing sculptor in as much as he was teaching in a school and had given up his teaching job to pursue sculpture for a year. So he just needed premises, and he needed some company in terms of people working there. Since the arch was so big, it was quite easy to have up to four people using that space. So
How much rent did you pay? Do you remember?
it started off, the rent was very different to Acme's. It was a much more commercial concern. It was about £1,500 per annum. And that was a starting rent. I think it went up to about 1,700, and then very little was done in terms of development of it. It was the responsibility of rail track, in as much as any really major work renovation. What they did was they closed arches down as such, did them up, and then reopened them and got prospective tenants. We didn't really want to move out of the arch, so any work that was offered was having to be done while we were there, which wasn't really a good enough setup, in as much as the arch needed electrics properly to be done, and it needed water to be put in, and toilet facilities, none of which was done while we were there. So we had to use the toilets in the arch right at the top of the lane, which belonged to the plumbing centre, which was a shop on the Grove Green Road. And the electrics were installed many years ago. There was an electric supply from an adjacent property on Pretoria Road, which was just literally across at the back of the arch. And so there was an electric cable which was installed, which was a proper supply. And apparently that was written into the contract for the arch. Whoever took on the tenancy also had the power assured. So that was great. Only thing is, it was never, we never knew whether it could be cut off by the tenants moving into the house on the street, because they did do a renovation there, and what they did was somebody actually cut through the cable and cut all our power off once. And when we told Railtrack, they looked up at the tenants' agreement and found that it wasn't acceptable to cut the power off, so they reinstated it. So that was quite good. So we were in Arch 188 for about 8 years. Yes, it is.
Yeah, to have a studio. So you, what year was it that you finally left the railway arch?
Well, there were three arches together. We were in 188, and while we were there, other artists took on board an arch next door to us, and that was a much better arch. It was better stairs and everything. And in about 1997, they moved out, and it became vacant. So we asked if we could swap tenancies, which we did, and then stayed at Arch 181 or something like that. I can't remember now. 183. Anyway, it was next door to 187, so it would be 189 actually, I think, 189. And We moved into that in 97, I think, approximately. And I stayed there until 2002. It's another 4 or 5 years.
Whole area there and what was happening. Did you have any involvement in the public inquiry or any parts of the campaign or?
Yes, the public inquiry was our first port of call, in as much as we would get information from ACME as regards hand back dates or possibilities or whatever, and various developments with the road. And apart from getting information from ACME, there was a growing realization of the impact of the road. In as much as people, we are immediate neighbours, one of whom was a private owner, was offered compulsory purchase terms as regards his property, and slowly it was becoming apparent that a lot of people were going to be affected by roads, the road building program, which I think started in earnest in 1990, more or less. And so what happened was people were wanting to get more information about roads and houses that were going as part of preliminary work. And the best way for ACME to tell people about it was to let us know when there would be inquiries or plans published in the local library or whatever. So slowly people were getting to find out a bit more about meetings in the area, one of which was a public inquiry, which was, I think it was, must have been 1990, 91, something like that. And it was a case of voicing concerns or getting ACME to give a clear indication as to our position as a ACME tenant. So yeah, it was very hard to find out more apart from immediate details. We never knew what would happen the following year or whatever. So in a way, it was it only had its limitations. After 1992, I think it was obviously apparent that people were very strongly against the road building, in as much as there was no provision for rehousing. So we had large numbers of people who had to make a decision whether to stay in the area and move into alternative types of housing or renting, or move out of the area. A lot of people actually started moving out. People moved to other countries or to Scotland or wherever, really, or other parts of their country. So slowly the network started to thin out, and only Leighton Artist Group was actually operating as a artistic community. NELIA, North East London Independent Arts, were really made up of individuals who were working in other jobs. They weren't really part of ACME. Leighton Artist Group, they started in 1986, and they were many members from who belonged in ACME houses. So they just carried on working, having exhibitions to do with the Whitechapel. And I think they carried on till probably 91, 92, something like that, maybe. There were people like Christine Chittock, who was a member of Leighton Artist Group, and she'd probably have a better idea of when they continued with exhibitions. And their involvement was the road, with the road program. I think it was all to do with whose house went, really, whether they were. Because you had people who had moved out of the area, still had tenancy to a house, and they were obviously operating from somewhere else. They took on jobs. There was there was John Campbell Pye, I think. He was working in a college. By the time the road was a concern, road building was actually happening. He was working in a college elsewhere. He'd moved, but his house was still standing. At least he had people in there, and he occasionally turned up as well. So, he had a bit of absentee landlord going on as well. I mean, people didn't know whether they could really put roots down, so they would have to do whatever was necessary to survive.
Did you ever go to any of the public inquiries or
We
anything?
went to one public inquiry. Sheila Whittaker, I remember, went to that one, and we came back. They were like every Thursday or every Friday or something like that, and it would be any kind of fresh information, and it would be a declaration of who of certain houses that were being required by the DOT, and they were quite from it starting to be a case of an exchange of information, and a case of being able to put forward cases to which would alleviate the pressure of the building program. I think it was just a case of the DOT saying this is what's going to happen, and that's it. So once the road was actually, once compulsory purchase orders were the order of the day, then that was it.
Did you sort of, when you went to those meetings, how did you feel? Did you find it frustrating or?
I think I went to one, and then I didn't bother going to any of the others, because it wasn't the case that you could actually change the opinion of the people who were in power as regards to the road building. It was we were getting our information from ACME, and ACME were saying, well, when the houses are required, the houses will be required. You can go to the meetings, find out any imminent threat to your particular house, and then the rest of it was all about what was going to happen to the area. And there were plans. There was a model, I think, of the immediate development to Grow Green Road. There was a, I think it was cut and cover program. And I think in the end, rather than cover the whole road and tunnel it, they decided to put it into a cutting. So then they were never able to reclaim the land where the houses were, because that was lost to the road.
And also, I mean, you was there, weren't you, when the road protesters came on the scene?
Yes, it was a case of road protesting. Really, was to do with how people felt about roads in general, road building in general. So you had people from outside the area who were very passionate about opposing road building, and they moved into Leytonstone to protest against the road from an environmental point of view, because large areas of green, especially in Wanstead, were being claimed for road building developments. So you had work going on at Green Man Roundabout, Wanstead, Cambridge Park Road, and they basically, I think, from 1992, were adamant on opposing the road at whatever in their own particular way. So, yeah, I mean, ACME people tended to think in terms of their houses rather than what was happening in Wanstead. because in a way that's what they were immediately concerned with. But there was an amalgamation of opinion and feeling for certain. But we all, as regards our tenancy, had to undertake to return the house we were renting from via Acme. We had to return it to Acme. So once Acme said, you've got 6 months before we have to hand back, well, that's how we actually took it as sufficient, really.
And what about, in Dyer's Hall Road, the sort of more long-term residents? Did you have anything to do with...
No, I was always quite curious about if people who were who owned property, how do they feel in relation to the loss of their property and the impact it would have from their point of view on what was their neighbourhood as much as other people's. But as far as I'm aware, the DOT communicated directly to individuals with offers, compulsory purchase offers, and I think also they probably bought the property knowing there was the possibility of a road to be built. So they simply gave up their property when it was required. There was no community. There was a community other than artists who were being affected, and they probably went through the council, or they may have also dealt directly with Stop the M11 Link campaign. There was probably a contingent that was made up of householders. Stop the M11 Link campaign ran through right till 1994, I think. And they were very much involved with the people who were coming into the area to protest. But that was a different activity in relation to house protesting as regards the road. So they were quite political and quite sort of strong in their protest.
And when you used to socialise with the other artists, did you go to the Northcote pub or Heathcote? Which was your local?
There was two pubs in the area. There was the Heathcote, which was on the corner of Grove Green Road and Richmond Road, I think. And there was the Northcote, which was a little way down towards Leighton Station on Grove Green Road, and that was on the corner of Grove Green Road and Francis Road. And that was also a pub which people met. People met in two pubs, I think mainly in the Northcote, because in the Heathcote there was a lot of people who lived in the area but were not necessarily artists, and they used that. There was a snooker room and everything, whereas in the Northcote I think it was mainly there was a lot of artists went in there.
So because he was there for quite a long period, did you notice the same, the clientele in the Northcote changing?
Well, Friday nights used to be packed with artists, and people would sort of head off to the Northcote for a last drink and to catch up with whatever was happening in the area as regards shows, or just basically that there was a meeting place, and that was from any time from about 7 till closing time. So people would actually literally go over there and say, try and meet up. At the Heathcote, it was a bit different. Music happened at the Heathcote, so people would meet up for different reasons. It was a bit more spacious. So there was a lot of Irish music there, which took place. And that was from 1985 right through till 1989. So after 1990, both pubs started to change in their clientele, in as much as numbers dropped. Certainly the Heathcote, it was very sparse once people were once houses were being called back. People just moved out of the area, shops were affected. With the Northcote, I think after 1990 there must have been a drop of about 60% of people meeting up there. Certainly by 92-93, if people met there, it was to do with the road protesting rather than actually artistic business as such. So there was quite a drop. And then after 1994, the people started to move into the pub again. The pub sort of changed in character. I think there must have been a handover of management. A lot of, a lot less familiar faces. There may have been only two or three people really who lived in the area who would meet up at the Northcote. It was certainly not the same as in 1985, 86 or 87.
Around the latter years, was it a lot of road protesters in there?
I'm not sure if the road protesters actually used the pubs, to be honest, in the same way as previously. They were really keen on invigilating the houses that was being squatted in Colville Road, or I mean, they did obviously use the pubs, but it wasn't like a traveller's pub or anything like that. I didn't notice it as such. It was mainly people who lived in the area. So you had people working in Leytonstone or wherever, and they were just, so they weren't actually connected. So we used to go into the Northcote and we used to see people playing pool, as in any other pub in the area. But not necessarily protesters at all.
The road protesters would have their own parties, because I know they had a cafe, didn't they, down Claremont Road?
I think they were able to be to sort of sustain their presence on the road itself in terms of during the day and in the evening. So there was no. I think what they worried about was if people moved out away from the houses, that the DOT would send in people to evict them and board up the houses. So I think it was like 24-hour occupation for them. So they were quite happy with that. And I think in 1994, the summer of 1994, they were advertising the possession of Colville Road as an act of protest against the DOT. So, I think they were mainly living in Colville Road, totally.
They moved from Claremont Road to Colville Road, or I were think they across the two streets?
They were across the two streets. I think it was actually, Claremont Road, not Colville Road. Colville Road was a little bit further down, and a few houses were being squatted there, but it was Claremont Road that, because it was a cul-de-sac, it was like a ring. It had two openings onto Grove Green Road, and they basically put a little kind of a barricade, road barricade, on both ends of the road, and allowed foot people to come and go on foot, but no cars. And that was it was to do with the securing of those properties there as a demonstration against the road.
And do you remember the festival in 1990, the anti-M11 festival that happened in Claremont Road? There were sort of cabarets and things at the Northcote pub. And
I think 1990 was quite early, really. I think it was probably 94. By 94, the summer of 94, there was a lot of activity on the road. It was like a street theatre and the cafe, and the houses were made into kind of exhibiting spaces as well. That was definitely 94.
Okay.
1990 was probably when they were starting to use various houses, because people would have been living in 1990 on the road who would have been just individuals, householders.
That's right. I'm talking about the NOM11 campaign that artists and long-term residents were involved in.
Mm.
And they blocked off Claremont Road and had market stalls down there.
Yeah, 94, I think it was.
It was a fundraiser.
Oh,
then
it would have been, it would have been, oh,
Thomas and
it would have been, oh yes, and Edie Edward Worthy.
Mm.
Yes, some councillors. Yeah, there probably was a festival as such, definitely. It would have been for a week or two or something like that. But yes, definitely. Yes, yes. We would have, people would have, it would have been advertised, and it would have had people from Acme Houses and other local residents. But I guess there should be a chronological kind of breakdown as regards all the activity in Claremont Road from 1990 until 1994, when it really took up a lot of it was very
so can you describe Claremont Road, because like when you was living there when the road protesters came, did you walk down the street? And
yeah, I was involved with some of the artistic activities on Claremont Road, certainly in 1993-94, by which time I think all the properties had compulsory purchase orders, so people had moved out. There was an old lady who lived there who was born in that street, and she was featured in the Stop the M11 Link Road protests. Dolly, I think, her name. So from about maybe half a dozen houses that were Acme houses there, or maybe even more, maybe 10 houses, interspersed with private individuals having houses there, with exhibitions taking place from about 1990 through till 1994, when everybody had received their eviction orders as such who owned a house, including Acme people, to when those houses were boarded up, and then some were subsequently squatted, and the whole street was taken over by 94. There was various artistic exhibitions and demonstrations as such, and I think nobody quite knew how to decorate the road as such with the coming of the M11 Link Road, except until 1993, I think. There was this festival, a second or third festival. Yeah.
And tell me about that festival.
94.
Yeah, that one.
Well, the one I remember, and that was 1994, which was when they closed the road totally, and there was no sight of it ever being opened again, because they felt that it wasn't a case of they wanted people involved with the anti-road really wanted to demonstrate to their full potential. So there was a lot of sort of temporary structures made, scaffolding, and I think a scaffold tower was built with I think some road protesters scaling it, and I think it was on the news as well. And the people involved with that were really very dedicated environmental protesters who had come into the area, I think, from other places where such similar road building schemes were being challenged. I think from Twyford Downs and other places like that. So, yeah.
So you talked about there were a number of art events on the Claremont Road around that time. Could you say a bit more about those, what they were?
I don't really remember. There was probably there was a house watch. I mean, they used Claremont Road an awful lot. House watch would have been concurrent with a Leighton artist group, Artis Nelia. In fact, Housewatch, I think, was probably very early. I don't know when it started, Housewatch. Housewatch was a group of artists who used buildings as a projection screen to show films on the street. So they use the side of houses as well as the fronts of houses as a living kind of screen to show project films onto, and that was quite used to be one of the things we used to talk about at in the Northcote when the next House Watch film was going to be shown, and it would have a screening at an appropriate time once dusk had fallen, and people would literally take their beer from the Northcote and stroll across to Claremont Road and look at the latest films that were being produced by filmmakers in the area, who happened to be either ACME tenants or not, as the case may be.
When you said Nelia, what was that short for?
That was North East London Independent Arts, and they were based. They were a group that were. They were based in the area. We got to hear about them through Waltham Forest Arts Council.
And
they had exhibitions as well, which were advertised.
Housewatch were linked up with them?
No, Housewatch was a separate concern. Filmmakers who wanted to show their films on the street, so to speak. And they just simply organised themselves and they may have got involved with Waltham Forest Arts Council. They certainly received some funding from the Arts Council of Great Britain, because I think they wanted to what they had to offer was innovative and exciting and clearly of interest to people in the area, artists or whatever. I don't know much about them.
Yeah.
We saw lots of films.
Could you describe? Can you remember?
They were artist films, in as much as they were short films of about 5-10 minutes or 15-20 minutes, something like that. And they were made by filmmakers who wanted to use experimental film as a media.
And Claremont Road, what other events happened after Housewatch? Because it sounds like Housewatch were the first people working site specifically in that street.
I think they realised that these houses were going to change. They had already changed. They had acquired a new lease of life by being shortlisted. And they were interested in showing, linking with the history previously with maybe tenants who lived in the area still. They obviously got the permission of the people whose house they were using whenever they did screen films. And it was well received. But there were people who would literally come out of their houses and look at what was being screened on a house that was nominated for as a screen.
So presumably, you know, that those Housewatch pieces got quite a big audience, so there'd be an art audience and then people.
Yeah, up to maybe about 30-40 people, would turn up, yeah. Especially if it was well advertised in advance.
And what other art events do you remember down Claremont Road?
I can remember an exhibition that was in one of the houses that were handed back. It was a vacated house, and people put on an exhibition there, which incorporated installation, some sculpture, I think probably some some film itself within the house, definitely. Because you could actually show the outside of the house, and to show something going on in the inside of the house was another way of using these houses as a point of inquiry.
Was that the art house, or was that one of the open studio
It
events?
might have been both, actually. There might have been an art house that was slowly becoming a kind of resident exhibition space of some sort. I'm not that familiar because places had to be closed up and then opened up, so I don't know. It depends on whether they were. I think until 94, when all the houses were literally being squatted, the road was closed, and I think there was literally maybe the front doors were more or less open 24 hours a day, really. But up until that time, people would have been responsible for securing houses, maybe opening them up as a temporary showing space as part of whatever else was going on at the time. I think libraries were also a focus point for whatever. Either an artistic project or, but I didn't, I can't remember anything particularly.
Did you ever go to the cafe in Claremont
Yes, I went to the cafe. I think it was around about 93, certainly in the 90s. And that was good. That was great. That was I think run by Henry Cox and some of his friends. And it was a proper setup thing. It was very nominal. Didn't the prices of sandwiches and toasted sandwiches and teas and coffees were all very token. It wasn't expensive at all. It was mainly just to as a venture. I think they were just keen on getting people to kind of come and visit, and rather than just browse and see exhibitions, they thought they could feed them as well.
So was it like an artist who set up the cafe, or?
No, Henry Cox, I think he was involved with the Stop the M11 Link Road, and Henry, I mean, he was an artist, but he wasn't an artist through Acme. He was, I think he lived in a house where there were actors who lived in that house, and they were based in a house in Diatol Road. I think it was, I can't remember the number of the house. It was further along towards Grove Green Road. And that house, I think, was a focus for demonstration as well. They had meetings, the M11, Stop the M11 Link Road had meetings there. I can't remember the exact number of the house, but.
So the cafe in Claremont Road, it was set up by no M11
Yes.
protesters rather than the anti-road protesters.
Stop the M11 Link Road group.
So there were like people
Well,
who
probably,
were
but probably both.
long-term residents who.
I think Stop the M11 Link Road group would recruit from whoever were.
So by this time, would you say people were kind of mingling a lot more? Because you do get the sense that there were quite separate communities in a way.
Yes, it depended on how people felt towards the prospect of the Link Road. Some people wanted to protest in whatever way was possible, either through Acme or, I mean, Acme wasn't actually entertaining protest. Acme were not able to offer that simply because it was not tenable from their their point. They were empathetic and sympathetic to people's situations, but they could not openly oppose the Link Road, because their whole remit was temporary housing until the road was decided on, and that was that.
So going back to Harry Cox's cafe.
Henry,
could you describe how it was all, you know, what it was like? Did you eat inside, or did they have tables outside? Like, what
was, I think it was a very temporary concern, because they were trying to see if they could cope with the house being turned into a cafe. It was downstairs. They knocked out some of the walls, so the decor was very very basic. It was supporting timbers, supporting the upstairs floor, so it was spacious. I think it was food was produced in the kitchen, the existing kitchen. I think there was plans to try and get it more licensed as a eatery, but then that would have meant going to the local council. That would have meant an awful lot of red tape, and I'm not sure if they were able to take that on board. So yeah, you could get a sandwich made and then sit inside or sit outside on the street and look at the houses and or whatever else was going on. But I don't think it was a very much of an ongoing concern until maybe later on, when they knew what they wanted to achieve.
Oh, and what was that?
I think they wanted to achieve some sort of artistic autonomy and community within on Claremont Road, and that was done, I think, in 1994 by closing the road and having an exhibition of the street exhibition with an environment made.
Can you talk more into that?
Sure.
Yeah, so can you describe that place then, as where...
It's very exuberant, the spirit in the summer of 1994. The pavements were all painted with markings other than yellow lines, so they'd made chessboard on one part of the road, and then they'd had flowers painted on the road. There was settees in the middle of the road. There were tables. Come to think of it now, with the tables there, that meant that people could actually sit and eat as well. So I would imagine, I went a couple of times to Claremont Road and had something to eat and sat there and enjoyed the ambience. They put tarpaulins, because it was quite a hot summer, I seem to remember, 1994. Funny enough, I think we had snow in February of that year. I think it hadn't snowed for such a long time. It was either that year or the year before. And certainly in the summer of 1994, it was really, really warm and very pleasant and great to sit outside with these structures that were made by people, various people. And people would spend plenty of time outside rather than in the houses, so it was quite active, and there was music. There was a big party, several parties, I think. I think they had musicians actually as well. There was a little stage made, and I remember some music as part of that day's events. There was a musician, saxophonist, who played with his band, and that was great. It was quite something.
And did you get to meet quite a lot of interesting people there? Because It must have been quite friendly.
Oh yeah, it was totally, it was almost like a festival in a park. It was not that far removed from something that might have been happening in Finsbury Park or anywhere, or in Hyde Park or whatever. I mean, the scale of it wasn't huge, but it was certainly well attended. It must have been at any one time 40-50 people must have been, especially on the day of the actual events. I think it was like, because it was throughout that summer, maybe one Saturday there might be music, another Saturday there might have been street performance of some sort, another Saturday or Sunday there might have been filmmaking being shown. Cars were decorated, cars that were parked, because cars weren't actually being used on the street. So there were cars which were abandoned, which were remade into installations or sculptures. They cut cars up in half, bodywork and stuff like that. In fact, I got involved in one little project which involved cutting up a car. Well, so I heard that through Christine, who said we need somebody to work on a car or two, and we need somebody who is familiar with using tools. Can we borrow some tools? And I said, no, you can't borrow any of my tools, because a 9-inch angle grinder is not a nice thing to have to
maneuver.
So I said we'd quite happily come over. I think people I share the studio with, we went over in the afternoon and did something there for a few hours, and then left it to other people who used parts of the car inside the house and juxtaposed the references of the street with the references of inside the house. So it was great fun, and then we could see the results of that weekend as part of the events that were taking place.
Would you say there were quite a lot of acme artists involved in that as well, in that street?
Acme artists did get involved, except the fact was acme artists were also deciding whether they were going to stay in the area once their houses were being called back. And bear in mind that 94 was when Claremont Road was cordoned off. There was at least 50% of acme artists had moved out of the area. Mm. So yeah,
because you mentioned film screen there as well, and I'm wondering if maybe John Smith or Ian
John Horn. Yes, they would have been involved. John was certainly in the area right up until, I don't know, I mean, he may even live locally. I know he was working as a filmmaker well after the 94. And Ian Bourne, I mean, he must have been in the area, and he would have been carried on working after 94. In fact, I met Ian recently, and at an exhibition. We're talking about 2007 now.
Yeah.
When I met him at an exhibition on Grove Green Road in something similar taking place at a place called 491. And I think that's an artistic venture that's currently in the area.
And you mentioned Christine. Is that Christine Binney or Christine?
No, Christine Chittock.
Yeah.
She was very, very active with the protesting and with the people who were coming into the area to protest. And Christine lived in 188 Grove Green Road, and that was one of the houses that were initially called back. And then she moved to 101, which subsequently was not required for development. And I'm, as far as I'm aware, I think she may still be there.
Okay. And did she do sculpture as well?
Yeah, Christine Chittock was a member of Leighton Artist Group from 1986, and she never really joined Art East. She never joined Art East. She wasn't part of Art East, but she was part of Leighton Artist Group. during the late 80s and early 90s.
That's interesting. I had no idea really of how the artists were kind of working in Claremont Road, because I always assumed that that work out on the street was the road protesters, but no, it was.
I think it was really the road protesters who wanted to design a space which would be open to anything that was creative. And they wanted it to justify its existence in the with the advent of the DOT, with the advent of the M11 Link Road being planned for by being boarded up, houses being boarded up, and people could use a street as a way of getting round, because Grove Green Road used to get chock-a-block in the morning with traffic, so people could nip in one end of Claremont Road and then nip out of Claremont Road and join the traffic a little way down. And beat the traffic jam, because traffic was really, really bad. Around 8:30, Grove Green Road just used to get blocked, and there was these little roads like Claremont Road and Colville Road, which was a little way of speeding your journey up down Grove Green Road, if you could call it that. And people literally did that. So when houses were being boarded up, people still used the road, and the protesters didn't want that. They wanted to link the houses that were being affected, the area that was being affected, with the road, and they just thought they could make the whole thing an environment of peaceful protest.
Called Mick Roberts. Do you remember him? Because he put a scaffolding up on his roof of his house with a noose.
Well, I would imagine that was all part of the ultimate protest in 94. Yeah, I didn't know Mick. I was probably more aware of the changes to the road rather than individuals who were involved in particular activities, acts or whatever of protest. But yes, that tower really grew. I think it started off as a scaffolding going across the road, to high, literally to hang things for street performances or whatever, and it must have just simply just grown as a structure.
When you was walking towards Claremont Road, could you see that?
Oh yeah, you could see the scaffolding, and later on, I'm sure you could see from the other side of the railway. So you can see from Cathall Road and Leytonstone High Road, probably. Yeah, I remember seeing it from the from Cathall Road, which is a road that goes over from Grove Green Road over to Leytonstone High Road. It's a road that goes over the railway, and you could see the scaffolding quite clearly. It was about, I don't know, how would you measure it? About several stories high, maybe about four stories. Three stories, something like that. Three stories high. So we're talking about first, second, maybe third story. So it would be, yeah, like a very tall attic. Well, higher actually, probably. And yeah.
Did you travel up on the underground a lot past Claremont Road? Did you ever go on that central line, say to Leytonstone? Because I'm just wondering what that street looked like from the railway line.
Yes, the railway line runs above ground, so you can see quite clearly through the carriage windows the backs of all the houses of Colville Road and Claremont Road. So you could see, and people basically wrote slogans on the backs of their walls well prior to 1994. I mean, from 1980. 685, and there was Stop the M11 Link Road. It was written, I think, on a couple of houses, which gave you an understanding of which road it was. So yes.
So, can you remember the first bit of graffiti that was around the 80s in that road?
When I moved into the area, there was already graffiti on the walls of the backs of the houses.
So you remind me again when you moved in again.
1985.
Right, so from 85, local residences would have...
Oh, there was a couple, yes, had written in red paint, stopped the M11 Link Road, or, yeah, something like that, something brief.
Mm.
Or M11 Link was, I think, one of the things written.
That was so that commuters could see that.
Yes, so that commuters could see it as the train was pulling into Leytonstone Station. The last road that the train would pass would be Dyas Hall Road, and there was a house... On Dyas Hall Road, which was, I think, number 40 odd or so, and they had something written on the wall, M11 Link, written in red paint.
Right.
So people knew they were coming into Leytonstone Station.
Yeah. And so then over the years, that built up.
Well, trains would be held outside Leytonstone Station sometimes for a few minutes, so people in the houses would have been aware of that, and they would have written things to be seen and pondered over.
Yeah. And so when did the houses on Claremont Road really start getting painted up? Like, what year would you say?
I'd say in the 90s, 92 maybe, 92, because I think we thought things would have happened between from 91, 92, and then there was... It wasn't decided until the following year, for some reason or other. So then 93 was obviously a stage in developments. And then 94 was literally when Claremont Road was the only bastion as such for protest. Because by then, people had moved out. Houses were being handed back. There was a program of return of houses. My house, I literally had to hear that it was required before I moved out, which was 93, 94, well, 94, because I was trying to see if I could move into a house in the area, and the only thing that was possible was hard to let flats in Cattle Road towers.
So that's what was being offered by ACME?
No, that wasn't being offered by ACME. ACME couldn't offer anything.
Right.
That was being offered by the council in relation to the impact of homelessness to people who were being given notices to quit.
Mm.
So Cattle Road has had, at that time, three tower blocks, which had properties, had flats in them which were vacant.
Mm.
So as a last ditch of way of help, ACME were told that they could, considered for a flat from the council. Nothing to do with ACME. ACME had moved out of the area once the houses were given back. And if I wanted to, I needed to apply to the council for a tenancy in one of these places,
mm-hmm.
which I did. And in the summer of 94, I was able to secure a flat, which I was happy with. And I was able to literally move from the ACME house into a flat in Cattle Road.
And what was that flat like?
The flat was fine, it was okay, it was warm, it had central heating.
Wow.
It was, but it was, the flats, the area was fairly notorious for vandalism,
mm-hmm.
and these flats were hard to let places. And even that was temporary, because I think the council was trying to decide whether to knock down the flats and build low-rise housing, so there was a possibility that would happen in a few years' time.
Mm.
which did actually happen.
Oh, did it? And how many rooms did you get in that flat?
It was a one-bedroom flat, so it was one bedroom plus kitchen, bathroom.
But you still had the railway arch at this time?
Yes, I still had the railway arch as a studio. And I had no intention of using a flat as a studio, if I could help it. Because it was just, we didn't know whether we were going to be on the first floor, ground floor, or on the 13th floor, who knows. So it happened to be on the walkway, so it was like ground floor, but I was just lucky to get that kind of a flat. It could have been somebody also in an Acme house who had to move out across the road from me. Had to move into a second floor flat in Cattle Road, and he moved in. He was a filmmaker, Tony Potts.
And a bit about the circumstances in which you'd left your Acme place. I mean, how did that come about?
Oh, it was just simply we were given a final eviction date, or a date when we were asked if we could move out by. And it was negotiable in as much as until they really, basically, if people moved out, they boarded it up.
Yeah.
And if they boarded it up, then there was a possibility you could get squatted. So until it was actually to be demolished, people could stay, provided they were happy with the fact that they'd have boarding close by, next door, whatever. So you literally had boarded up houses with houses in between that were being lived in. So people, it was quite strange, really, because if you were using a house, you'd have your front door next to a boarded-up house. So you could have boarded-up houses on both sides, and this is one house in between, which is fair enough. I mean,
so was you one of the last people to go then? Because did you go in? Was it 94?
Yeah, I was one of the last people. Christine was one of the last people. Jenny and Ian, who lived on Grosvenor, they were one of the last people. There was various people.
So there must have been quite a lot of boarded up houses around you at
yeah,
that time.
There was.
So, like, could you give me an idea of the expanse?
I think probably every fifth house was boarded up, if not two or three houses in together were boarded up. It might be a case, well, in some instances, there were literally two houses being used amongst five, six houses boarded up. So it's just, I mean, Colville Road was boarded up. A lot of people moved out of Colville Road, which there must have been compulsory purchase orders, because there were fewer artists on that road than there were house owners. Mm-hmm. So they got, literally, you'd have one house, two houses, that were still being lived in by artists, and the rest of them were all boarded up.
Yeah, so do you think, like, the artists generally stayed there a lot right to the bitter end, in a sense?
Oh yeah, definitely, because what else could they do? Unless they had somewhere to move to, they were literally paying rent, which was not an awful lot, and householders would have moved out once their compulsory purchase orders were processed, I guess, and they received. I did hear about the market value of those properties had dropped tremendously, so they were given something like about 40,000 for a property. And then when properties were developed, in as much as if they weren't required for demolition for the road, if they went back onto the, if they became residential properties again, because the DOT took them on board, boarded them up, and then either knocked them down or opened them up again. I think they were expected to return to their former values.
And also around that time, you have the big slump in the housing market anyway.
Oh yes, so yeah.
Right down.
Yes.
To round about, you could get two bedroom houses for about 40,000, but the houses that were really close to the motorway were going really cheaper than that.
Probably, yeah.
I remember.
And then when they were redeveloped or subsequently not required for the link road, I think they went back up to about 70, I think, in some instances. As soon as the market was able to sustain it, I think it became people bought into the area. They might not have had much of a garden, but they certainly had the houses were developed as such because builders worked on them. There's a few houses which show signs of development since the M11 Link Road, and I would imagine they probably are of a marketable value now.
And when you left, did you just go to Acme and hand back the keys
Well, the
and
process was quite simple. Acme wanted to be around to receive the keys, to then tell the demolition people to board it up, that they were happy possession had been transferred. So we had to tell Acme that the morning we were leaving, and meet someone from Acme to give the keys to them personally. They then checked the house to make sure that it was as they were expecting it to be, that there were no people hiding under the floorboards or such. And then they would, unfortunately, it was either to be boarded, it was going to be boarded up. So what they did, demolition people came in, smashed up the toilets, bathroom, windows, boarded up everything, put a big metal grate over the door, and that was it. You'll have to ask someone. I lived in the house really for a complete answer, because Mark was very much affected by the imminent destruction of the house, and wrote lots of messages on the inside of the house in charcoal for the builders to. I'm sure the builders were just doing their job. Things like, this was once a house, and we lived here, and there was a group of people who lived in this particular house, and this was my bedroom, and this kind of thing would be written as a farewell message to the house. So yeah, it was. I mean, I didn't feel. I felt upset in as much as the loss of all those that effort and putting the house in order in the first place. But really, there was nothing we could do. We just had to. I mean, Acme just said, don't get too involved with thinking about other than the fact that you lived there, and that was it. Well, they were very pragmatic. Well, they had to be. They had to be pragmatic. They had to either have a policy that would allow them to operate with the houses, or it wouldn't be a policy at all. It wouldn't, it would, if they got involved in the Link Road protests, they wouldn't be able to function as a housing association with temporary stock, housing stock,
So
so.
it sounds like they were like offering advice, in a way that
Yes.
they were
They were offering advice
supportive.
and they were supportive, and they certainly provided a link with other organisations like the council, the DOT, other housing associations. So we had no problems with getting references or information. And they forwarded applications to other concerns like the council and housing associations. It depended whether they had the time and the resources to do that.
So you got that flat on Cat Hall Road. So how long did you stay in the area till this?
I moved into Cattle Road 94 until 1998, when that area was earmarked for redevelopment, and that meant the destruction, the dismantling of the tower blocks. So they dismantled two tower blocks. I mean, literally, what they were doing, they were dismantling the tower block I was in. So they were dismantling it from the top upwards, from the top downwards. So it was, I think it was 6 stories, and I was on the ground floor. So literally, the upstairs were being dismantled, and the the lifts were stopping on fewer and fewer floors.
They were actually just landing while you still lived there.
Yeah, well, they had to. It was a slow process.
Oh,
it's no problem.
Yeah. So
they were building scaffolding and dismantling it bit by bit. I mean, dismantling it in as much as, I think, to be honest, I think it was about making him unusable. So they were closing down the walkways on certain higher levels above me were closed, because it was you could walk between flats. You could walk on the ground level, then you could walk, I think, two or three floors above. There was another walkway between the flats. So once they were, yeah, it was, they were closing them down.
So all in all, you have gotten quite used to living in
temporary
demolition.
Housing, demolition sites. Yeah, you could say that.
So, how long did you live in the Acme houses? It was 1985,
July 1985, until
1994.
Until would have been probably August 1994.
So, I mean, that's 9 years.
That's so 9 years, yeah.
Really substantial amount of time. And then, well, all in all, in the area, you lived there 12 years.
98, yeah.
So what did you, like, when you look back on that time, what do you sort of think about it? Because, I mean, do you think, like, that period could ever be repeated, you know, in all the different situations?
Looking back on that period of time when I was in the area, and I just have fond memories of all that was possible with such a group of people, and the structures of the road and the houses and everything. In a sense, a community that was there. We're talking also pre-digital community, because now everything's different.
Mm.
So you had people popping into shops, and you had people using photocopiers and shops, and that was about the limit of the technology. We didn't have any internet cafes as such. So people met up to literally for leisure purposes. I mean, now it's different now. It's traffic moves a lot quicker through the area. Everything's much, much faster. But then they would always say that. I think it's to do with the fact that the road is different. It's the roads in that area are different now. They're divided between the link road, which passes through. So you've got two areas, distinct areas of Leytonstone. You've got Leytonstone on one side and Leytonstone on another.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they have their conurbations of residential roads, which enjoy a similar network of people. It's just that the artistic community along Grove Green Road and Dyers Hall Road and Philibrook Road and Colville and Claremont Road just doesn't exist. That isn't there now. So you've just got a link road that moves traffic continuously. It was a great opportunity to do things as an individual, as an artist, and also collectively with other people. I think it was fortunate because we had that kind of structure with residential properties, short-term properties. If you don't have those kind of properties, you don't have that kind of community, I think. Then you have individuals who live in properties who may wish to meet up as a community if they have collective interests or whatever. So, yeah, it came about, I think, through having short life property with artists living in them. Without those kind of facilities, you wouldn't have that kind of community. It'd be maybe more widespread. It wouldn't be so focused or can
You had to stop work, didn't you, at one point? Was that because of your not being able to sustain a live work situation in the same way?
Well, I think stopping work in terms of making my own art.
Yeah, did you
I
think?
think I think I had to always, even during those years, had to think about how to balance my artistic activities with making a living. And I think living in a place which was not expensive, very affordable, allowed for more time to be spent making art. And I think that's a basic economic fact. So now, not making art is primarily to do with not because I don't live in a similar sort of setup, or I haven't got that kind of resource. It's just financially impossible to devote as much time to making art and justify living costs.
Because I think particularly you was working quite large scale, life-size sculpture.
I mean, if I needed to continue, I would have to look for commissions, or I'd have to look for sponsorship or something like that. And that I did try and do, but it's not really, unless you have some kind of link with a college or university or a gallery or some sort of structure, you can't really exist on the open private market, either as a householder or as a tenant. You just can't afford the rent. You can't afford the rent and the actual rent that people pay nowadays when they live in a house or a flat, as well as pay for a studio, which is also quite expensive.
So do you think that a kind of live work situation could ever ha happen again?
Well, it can only happen if there isn't those market forces which make people have to pay rents which are solely to do with working and finding enough money to pay the rent.
Because when you was in your Acme house, can you remember how much rent you paid?
Yeah, the rent and the Acme house was the most it ever ra it started off at £75 per calendar month for a two-bedroom property, and it went up to 90 or maybe just over £90 a calendar month. And we're talking about incremental increases over a number of years, and that was mainly it went straight to them. It wasn't even profit-based for Acme's. They were not making any profit at all. So, unless there is a kind of peppercorn rent, there's no way that people can actually.
Yeah. And I remember you mentioned you'd heard a story about a guy who didn't have, was it electricity put into his house?
Yeah, I heard a story of somebody who didn't put electricity into his house because they were told back in the 70s that the M11 Link Road was being considered, and he deemed it not viable to go to the expense of putting electricity in his house. How true that was, I don't know, but it seemed to be. I think it was one of the. I think he became a member of the No Stop the M11 Link Road. I think he may well have been a member.
So did
I
he
seem to
have
recognize.
gaslighting in his house?
I think if he had gaslighting, even that must have got changed to something more. Well, yeah, he might have had. I mean, certainly gaslighting was. There were gas pipes in the houses. So at some stage, there must have been gaslighting. But I mean, I never made inquiries as to whose house, which house particularly. But I think it was on Dyersall Road.
So do you know who the source of that story
No, I don't
was
know
from?
this. I heard it through somebody else. So.
there anything else that you think about particular about that time? Because such a lot happened. It's like...
Well, it was very stressful for people who really, really hung on to their house and who really wanted, were hoping that there would be some rehousing for them. And it was very stressful for people who were in that position, who wanted to stay in the area somehow. And in that kind of rented accommodation. And it was unbearably stressful for some people, especially, I can remember Christine Chittock, she really suffered, and consequently became like a health issue for her. And as much as she was supported by ACME, and subsequently ACME were able to get a few houses back from the program of demolition, and I think she got rehoused. I'm in one of the houses that wasn't required, and I don't know where. Maybe she took up permanent residency there.
And just going back to the last days there, was it kind of noisy because you had all this demolition work going on?
Oh yes, it would be noisy. I mean, it was a case of. Well, noisy in as much as when houses were actually being demolished, but the thing I remember was just that fact that these houses were just boarded up and left waiting their ultimate demolition, which I think they would happen in groups. So at some stage or other they would be demolished, but until then there were just loads and loads of hoarding. On the side of the street, and that was the way in which you sort of walked along the road.
So how did that feel, in a way? The atmosphere?
It was just sad, really. I mean, there's not much you could say about that. You sort of could picture all these houses before the hoardings, and then when the houses were even demolished, you could still remember the houses. Mm. In fact, I can still remember all the houses on Grove Green Road. And none of those houses are there now. It's just literally an embankment at the side of the motorway with some gardens that are being planted, some pedestrianised areas.